please call the roll?
Yes. Chairman Christensen.
Present.
Commissioner Demarest.
Baldino, was he absent?
He's excused.
Commissioner Dirksen.
Here.
Commissioner Jensen.
Here.
Commissioner Rodman.
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Here.
Commissioner Tuttle.
Do you know if she was excused or absent?
I'm not proof.
Okay.
Absent.
Okay.
Thank you, Dave. At this time, we have open for comments from citizens. Anybody who would like to make a comment that is pertaining to items that are not on tonight's agenda, feel free to come up and speak. If you do speak, we'd like to keep it to 5 minutes if possible, so that invitation is open now. So anybody would like to speak, come on up.
Okay, so I'm changing the attendance. Commissioner Tuttle is here.
Nobody? The DEIS is on tonight's agenda. So if it's pertaining to the DEIS, we're going to hold off any comments on that at this time, but if it's outside of the DEIS, that'd be fine.
Part of the agenda is that he's coming over from Frank.
Yes, right.
So that wasn't applied to this Tuesday.
Right. So if it's not pertaining to the draft environmental impact statement, you can come up and make comments. Anybody? Okay, nobody's wanting to make comments, so we'll move on to approval of minutes. We have August 12th minutes. Commissioners?
I would move to accept the August 12th minutes. Before we do that, I just have two small notes.
Okay.
Last paragraph, first page, there were light leaning, so there will light be no. Should be lightly. Last paragraph, first page.
Yes.
First sentence, there will light lean.
Oh, okay.
And then on page two, second bullet point, I'm a little confused here. If the law is litigated, the state will administer marijuana and collect significant revenues.
Wow, that's a change.
Woo.
I think that's true.
That's actually pretty much verbatim language from Attorney Snyder.
Okay, attorney.
Yes. I think what he was referring to is if this is challenged in some way and litigated, that the state will administer and there will be significant revenue. That's the way I took that.
Yes, it's the way to administer.
Here. Could be missing a word, but still administer?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. As long as the attorney's intent is fairly represented and okay with this, but it seems like a nonsensical sentence to me. Then look back. Something else?
Would you like to change
that? I would accept it. Yeah.
Okay, we have a motion to accept minutes with stated changes of light to likely on the last paragraph of the first page. Second?
I second that.
Okay, seconded by Commissioner Sherwood. Any discussion?
So given that the attorneys are not here, how do we decide that?
I fall?
Well, what I can do is speak with Scott and clarify that sentence. Let's do that. And then we'll revise that in some slight way.
We need to revise the minutes anyway. We need to change the minutes then?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to hold off.
Let's wait.
We'll hold off on these minutes then until that change is made.
Question. So are you then withdrawing instead of having the motion to approve the corrections, you're withdrawing it?
Yes, the motion is withdrawn.
Okay.
Okay. Minutes for August 26th.
I have one thing on the third page, last bullet point, second bullet point from the bottom is snow country instead of sun country.
Change the season.
Those were the main points that were touched on, and our intent tonight was to bring this back to debrief just a little bit on that public hearing. And we do have Susan Boyd here from PACE, so that if there are questions that have come up since we last discussed this, or any comments on the public hearing, anything you want to discuss further in a little more detail with Susan, she's here for that discussion. But I should remind you that the commission does not have authority of approval or recommendation on this EIS. It is administrative, but this is all about informing your decision on the recommendation. So with that, I'll hand it back to you and let you carry on some discussion.
Okay, my first question is since this was a public hearing and that public hearing is closed, I'm not sure what we can or cannot comment on or say or do at this point, so I'm a little bit tentative about it.
Well, we consider that like an open record public hearing, and we are still accepting comments, written comments, until the Friday of this week, the 13th.
Okay. And that includes the commission? I mean, as far as our comments towards this EIS?
Yes, we are still open to comment.
Okay. And I just want to make sure it's not missing. Okay. Commissioners? I had one question. I was here at the meeting on Thursday, and in the term worst case floodplain was used a number of times. And worst case, I guess, is still not in place. It's not official yet. Am I right, Susan?
Yes, we took the, what we called the worst case was the assumption that the new FEMA maps, the preliminary maps, would be adopted and used for development, and that does put additional restrictions on the type of development, the amount of development that would be able to occur without filling the property. So the floodplain elevation on the preliminary maps is a little bit lower than what it is on the current FEMA maps. Fill required to bring certain areas of the site up above the floodplain elevation.
Okay, my concern was with using the worst case was that it kind of leads the EIS in a certain direction. And my assumption is that the draft EIS is supposed to be, you know, not
biased.
Biased one way or the other. So by using worst case, because that is not official yet, my concern was, does it push it one way or the other? What are the ramifications of
that? Yeah, I understand what you're saying, I think. And I think that it's important to know that we haven't put forth specific development conditions or scenarios or a development proposal. We are only trying to demonstrate alternatives based on different regulatory requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some discussion, I guess, whether or not the city of Monroe has actually adopted the preliminary maps or not. And that's why we thought, just take the most conservative approach in worst case, in this case, is worst case for the property owner or the developer, in that they would be required to do more earthwork than might otherwise be required. So it's not a function of what the proposal is, it's a function of what's actually allowed during development.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't impact the proposal. It does impact what the property owner may or may not be able to do in the future when they do try and develop. Does that help clarify it?
Well, it helps in the sense that I can understand where you're going with that, but it still bothers me a little bit that we're using figures that still aren't official.
Yeah.
And it,
I guess I could
I
be...
I think at the time when they go to do a project, if there is a project in place, that's when this whole thing would, you know, have to be worked out one way or the other.
Exactly. Well put. And that's... It's just so hard to bridge this gap between a non-project EIS and
right.
what are the potential impacts.
Right.
I believe that the elevation, for the most part, the difference in the current approved FEMA maps and the proposed FEMA maps is about a foot and a half. And so, it's, in some senses, it's not that significant, but it's such a piece of property that a foot and a half can make a fair amount of difference. What it did, in effect, was reduce the developable area that we're showing. If the maps got kicked out for some reason in the future, they might get a 20 feet extra this way or that way. It's not a huge difference in the amount of developable area, but it could make a difference.
Yeah, okay. I just want the record to show that I'm concerned with, you know, when we're using terms like worst case or best case, where we don't have, you know, official
definition
yet. Thank you for that.
I think
that's what I was looking for.
It's a good comment that we have an opportunity to make sure it's not in the final EIS. Make sure that those, you know, subjective words aren't there.
I would appreciate that. That's the biggest comment I had.
All the follow-up to that is using, and I not, you know, not the word worst case, but using that potential future floodplain definitions and so forth, you've drawn up from the 42 acres, and I can't find the page here, so many acres of developable or buildable.
About 10.
Right. If that worst case doesn't come to pass, and in fact it is what it is today, I would almost rather see that in this EIS is saying this is what we really could develop today, not next month or next year when these things might change.
We could certainly show both. I'd be hesitant to go with the current FEMA maps because there's some ambiguity as to what the city has adopted. As far as their maps, the city may have adopted the preliminary maps. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't want to make that decision. But showing both is appropriate.
As of now, the worst case, in my mind, looks like less impact is had because of what's being proposed. As opposed, you know, it might show a potential greater impact by having the today's maps instead of the worst case maps.
I don't think so. Actually, I can say with certainty that the impacts won't change. The actual number of acres impacted or whatever, the numbers are estimates. And so they're going to vary a little bit one way or another. But I could do a quarter of magnitude. You know, it could be up to 10% more or 10% less, something to that effect.
Right. I mean, even if it only adds 10%, that would impact like the traffic numbers that you have, and all the other numbers or some of the other numbers might be similarly impacted.
I can understand, Susan, how difficult it must be to try and put something like this together without a project behind it, because there's so many scenarios that could go, and I totally understand that. I just want to be as subjective as possible to this whole thing. Make sure that we're straight and forward on this thing. So, any other comments? Commissioner Jensen?
What others? If nobody else has anything.
And there's more questions, and you maybe just help me understand if I'm understanding what you're describing with the impacts. But I wanted to bring up one of the charts here, if you move that to
far back.
The one with the cross section.
Oh, the planting plan.
Yeah. That one will do. That one, or there's another one. But I think they're both the same. So I kind of have two questions, and maybe you can tell me, maybe they aren't covered by what the federal regulations require, or maybe it's just something that's missed, if I can get this pointer right. Let's see here.
I think it's that button. Yeah, it's that button.
Okay. So my one question is, you list this 100-year plane. I assume that's the worst-case line. Does that mean that once you've gone up and filled to 101 feet or 102 feet, or
yes,
maybe 101 years, 102 years, I'll use the term years, once you fill to that point, if you now were to fill another 20 feet, you don't have to do anything in here?
No. That it would actually be worse. If you wanted to fill up 20 feet more, what you have to do essentially is provide any storage that, so that would presumably be area that would be lost to help to hold.
Even though that's beyond 100-year plane.
Oh, good point. No, you could go higher. You're right.
That's what I was saying. You built up and you're on an impact for a 100-year plane.
And you go a little bit higher.
Yeah, and you go a little higher to be safe. And now I'm saying now you have 20 more feet because you just want to be. Whoever is building will be absolutely certain that nothing's going to happen. But do they have to do any further mitigation once they've already mitigated to that 100-year line?
I can't imagine anybody wanting to do that. In all my 30 years, I've never even
imagined
that.
I'm just trying to understand is the 100 years the, like,
but that's the threshold.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes, that is the threshold into which you have to provide the compensatory flood storage. Now, if you added 10 feet, you might have other visual impacts, or you might have to do erosion control because there's not enough room to go 20 feet higher without building huge walls and things mm-hmm. like that. So the site itself, just by nature, limits you in what's practical and allowed. So
right, okay. But flood-wise,
that's
the additional
all
impact.
Yeah. And we talked about it today, and maybe this helps simplify it, in that if the FEMA maps indicate that the site would be, that the water would come to 60, I guess it's 68 there, with the compensatory flood storage, the goal of the excavation and the providing the flood storage means that the flood would still be at 68.
Okay.
We're trying to balance that because we don't want to impact any other sites, and we don't want to impact downstream or higher waters on the hill. That was brought up a couple of times about erosion of the hill. Well, no, the flood elevation is not going to be any higher or lower with the mitigation that's required. That's the goal, is to protect, keep it level, balance it out.
Okay, so you're not, because I was worried if it was able to go up into this capacity, you're storing more water in the ground here as well.
Yeah.
You're saying that's not the case.
That's
you're keeping
not
the water
case.
Level the same. If,
yes.
We'll just say the same.
The same.
Now, what about the slope itself? So we have some slope here, and I know that, I think you said there's nothing will be touched here because that's on the north side.
Yes.
But if things were touched here, is there any risk of, even though it's below the water level, is it, adding something where more of this could slough off into it? And how is that something that you have to address in the impacts?
The answer is no, that the slope would not be impacted, and it would not create any additional erosion, and it goes back to that same scenario I just said where the height of the water is not going to change. On a site like this where you do have structural fill that would be required and, excavations and whatnot, a soils engineer would be heavily involved in doing testings and bore logs and whatnot to make sure that it could support the pilings or whatever they would use. And so that's another challenge for the property owner down the road.
Right.
So.
Okay. The only other section I wanted to look at, and I was here on Thursday and raised this question. I've tried to do a little more research, and I'm just finding more questions than answers. So I think I'll raise it here, and if you can help answer or not. And that is the alternative one option.
Yes.
Which
is right about there.
Right there, okay. And then there's a number of, I guess, baselines of which the impacts are drawn from based on alternative one, if I understand that correctly. So you propose that with the current thing, you could have a couple of buildings and so much traffic, and then alternative two and three simply have to show impact from that, I'll call it worst case, of option one. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, I don't know that it's worst case or best case for option one. I can think of other things that I wouldn't want to have there, but we're trying to do both. If you look at the traffic analysis, you'll see that, and I don't remember the numbers exactly, but you'll see that there's some number of vehicles or trips that would be generated.
1,600.
You're right. And then alternative two, it showed that it would be X number or X number, but we presented both numbers to show the total and the additional over the no action.
Right.
To try and demonstrate the difference between developing under current conditions or the, you know, the proposed rezone or the third alternative, which was mixed use. And so that's sort of in keeping with SEPA practices, if you will.
Right.
So
The part that feels odd to me is that alternative one, in my mind, it is the extreme case as far as traffic impact. Yeah, maybe somebody wouldn't want a rendering plant or some other concrete factory, but traffic-wise, this option is showing the highest level of traffic, presumably permissible under option one. And I'm concerned that while that might be technically correct, it's really not accurate as far as a true impact, because as from what I'm understanding, it would be very expensive. And I know we're not trying to deal with money, but in a practical sense, option one, which is no action, it would still be very expensive for someone to go build a health club or a church out there complete with road and all the parking. And so to me, it feels like it's an unrealistic no-action representation for option one.
Yeah, I can't really say. I mean, I would presume that anybody who owned the property would be looking for the highest and best use for the property. What an actual property owner or developer would do. I mean, I know a church has been proposed there before. And so is a church that far out of line? Well, we've already seen it proposed once.
But I don't think a church would generate 1,600 cars per day.
Maybe on Sunday they would, but not during the
year.
Yeah, I don't, you know, or maybe, I have no idea, but depending on the size and volume, you're right, there could be a very big variable there. The goal was to present what could happen there and how different is that from what's proposed.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
I'm not
questioning what's proposed at this point. I'm more questioning the baseline. To me, it feels like the baseline is a little bit slanted, again, to that worst-case notion rather than the more realistic case.
Yeah, I'm not sure what is more realistic. There's a lot of money been invested in this property already.
Right.
So to assume that it, you know, would develop as five homes is not realistic to me.
Right.
But anything can happen, you know. It's a tough question.
The part I've been trying to research, and I've been looking through the municipal code myself and trying to understand it, is your representation of parking. Okay, from everything I'm finding in the code, there's nothing in the code that implies that parking is automatic. It seems to imply that parking is part of the permissible or not permissible actions of the various zones.
Well, you've got quite a code. And the, the parking line that we talked about last Thursday, and parking being an accessory use or permitted use, in my interpretation, that means the Joe Diamond lot downtown, or a paid parking lot. And I've never been in a city where you could build a church or a school, but you couldn't provide the parking that was required for that use. So I just can't imagine the code being interpreted that way.
Every other zone in here has parking included as their permissible or accessory as needed, if it seems appropriate. It obviously doesn't have it under the residentials.
Yeah.
It does have it under all the different commercials and industrials. So, as I look through, I'm trying to find definition. They don't define parking directly, which in my mind, I think if there was anything involving pay, we would see more definition in here describing what terms about a pay lot or a not pay lot.
Yeah.
So the best, from what I can see, is the intent is that they would zone for parking to go with the other developments that might happen.
Paul, and do you have a comment on that? So we don't just continue on that.
Yeah, it's
as far as the municipal code on parking.
Well, actually, this question probably is not germane to the land use and zoning process, but again, simply what it means is that there are limitations on where you can provide parking for payment. Certainly, any development is entitled for parking to serve that facility. Otherwise, they couldn't build it. But the parking issue, I don't think, is really relevant to.
So even though there's nothing in there describing as defining a pay lot, you're assuming that it represents a pay lot.
A standalone parking lot that has no purpose other than park cars. That is not allowed in every zone. That's really what this is talking about. Again, this is really not related. This level of detail is not.
Okay.
Really necessary at this stage of the process.
The other question I would bring up is that indirectly to parking is, and maybe the untouched open space covers this, I don't know, but I saw that the maximum developable area of limited open space was 30%. Is that per plot?
That's per whatever parcel is being proposed for development, that would apply to that. Again, that's a more of a detailed zoning issue.
Well, I'm just trying to make sure to understand if we have an accurate representation of no action. If they've paved over too much beyond 30%, if that's in fact applicable, then that would impact, again, their traffic numbers and the impacts that this applies to the other alternatives.
It would. And again, that's a level of detail that we can't predict at this point.
I will say that
it's not a part of the decision.
Right. Well, the accuracy of the EIS is part of the decision, is it not?
But the accuracy is only as good as what the assumptions are. In this case, it's based on a theoretical alternative. It's to illustrate the possibility.
Right, but within the bounds permissible.
Right, and that no action alternative is illustrating what can be built without further entitlement, zoning, or land.
Right, and I just was questioning
what can physically be built. That's a function of an action.
Right, but I'm just questioning if that approximation has gone beyond the bounds of permissible.
No, I don't think so. Not at this level, because there are no specific sizes to that.
Can I just point out that that's parking and landscape area, and a good portion of this exercise is balancing square footage of building area to required parking and landscaping.
Okay. All right. I just know it's going to come down to bite the city, because if we have the wrong baselines, then we get less impact fees or mitigation fees when a real development comes along.
Commissioner Sherwood? I don't know whether this access to a redlined version that shows the changes between the draft and the plan. Is there any necessity or
requirement? I would say no.
All right, thanks.
The comments are each to be addressed, and those would be in an appendix, correct?
Yes, the plan now is to take all the comments that have been given to date and will be received until 5 on Friday and do a matrix of each one and address those and work it into the final EIS, which is scheduled for release on the 27th of this month.
So presumptively there will be changes as well within the document itself?
There very well could be, for clarification purposes, primarily I noted some of the suggestions you made on noting the date of the aerial photography. I thought that was a fantastic idea that I got down on the GIS guys about for not including originally. So there's some clarification matters at least at this point.
My only concern was having to read through the whole thing again. That's what I was getting at.
This is what I was striking out.
Sometimes there might be a summary that says, you know, what are the major changes in the letter or something.
Could yes.
Probably summarize something like that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Would there be a changes page, this page change, this page change, this page change?
In the matrix, it will say that if a comment was either noted or clarification made on page 7, so you'll be able to breeze through it. We'll put the changes in bold or something so it jumps out.
That would help a lot, as far as I'm concerned. You wouldn't have to go back, like Commissioner Shirley said,
yeah.
Read the whole thing.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
I just felt like the traffic numbers were too high, and I thought that. And that was all based on this.
Well,
and I know it's all approximate.
It goes back, Commissioner Jensen, it goes back to there is no project. So there really is, it's all based on, you know, magic, So it makes it very hard to do the EIS without a project.
The different alternatives are really just to help us look at impact mitigation, not really to set a baseline or to draw a comparison between the three different options.
Right, but if option one is
right, but
the most extreme and option two is more moderate, the difference between those and the mitigation and impact has been reduced.
And I guess I don't feel like there's extreme, moderate, worst case, best case. It's supposed to be factual, not given any leaning. So,
Commissioner Jensen did bring up one thing that I'm not sure how we handle that. Is that, and that's on, you know, building up the land above the floodplain. Does the city have a code? Is there something in this code that says you can't put a 200-foot mountain on your property to put your house on top of it?
Well, I suppose anything is possible if they met all the requirements for a grading plan.
But you have slopes that you need to maintain, and so you know you need to maintain a certain slope. Otherwise, it would tumble.
Yeah, I understand that. It just got in my head. So what? You know, what if the guy next door wanted to build a house, but he wanted to build it 40 feet high, you know?
If it was a small lot and it built a very large tower base, that would be a violation of the code. Yeah. Because the intent is 35-foot building height. And that would be
deliberate.
Yeah, you have to maintain your maximum.
Yeah, put a shophouse on top of it.
Yes.
Okay, that's the only question I have.
I guess I have one question here. It's looking also at the floodplain stuff. So in the development areas, do they all have to be graded up higher than they already exist?
A large portion of the site does need to be brought up to elevation. The historical activity on the site indicates that this area is higher and less flooding has happened. There's some low areas right through here that would probably need to be built up a little higher. And this where the land up here happens to be the highest and driest portion of the site, and where I wouldn't anticipate any fill in that area. This area here is very low, which is why there's nothing shown there.
Okay, thank you.
And I think that it is appropriate, even at a LIDAR 2-foot contour level, that will be added as an appendix.
Commissioners, any other questions, comments? Paul?
No other comments.
Comments or anything on this? So, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Should I put the sophisticated thing back here?
Okay, we'll move on to the next item, which is was item A, which is now item B.
Are you taking public comments on the EIS?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I think there are a few folks who are here maybe to speak on it.
Well, we usually don't.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But we, you know, if somebody had some comments, I guess we could.
Oh, because initially we're taking public comments on everything, but not the agenda items until we get to the agenda items. So I thought you were going to take on that agenda.
Yeah, I think Paul said, you know, we're still accepting written comments. So I guess if you wanted to make a verbal comment, I guess that would be fine too.
I would like to. We have before asked.
Pardon?
We have before.
Okay, if you would like to come up and make a statement, that'd be fine.
Yes, Michael.
Just give your name and address for the record.
Go here.
Yes, please. And that mic is working, David?
Yes. It is.
It is?
It's on.
Okay. I'm dialing in one sensor, and I'm aware of this proposed development. And I've been there since 68.
Uh-huh.
And when that river gets up, there's no control on it. It'll just roll around in there. It covers the whole area down below, the whole thing, clear across. From one bluff up down across the driveway clear on over. It'll just roll right through there into that creek. It goes into the creek, goes from the river under the road. That water comes right in there, rolls right on around the hill range and the heavy rain and stuff, and that water, it just rolls out in there. I don't know how it could ever keep the water from getting in there. It's a regular flood plain.
You might have asked how often it does that?
Whenever that, like Thanksgiving and the water gets high, it'll get in there. And the time of year when it's like flood time, it's been in there numerous times. Whenever the river comes up, the snow and the rain and the melt and all of that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, thank you so much for speaking. All right. Let's move on then to workshop for CPA 2013-A, comprehensive plan text amendments. Paul?
Yes. We've made some additional changes in the land use element. It is not yet complete. It was getting fairly close. But there have been no additional changes of the economic development chapter that you have tonight. But we plan to bring the final edited versions of economic development, land use, and housing, which is going to be a fairly simple update, to our next meeting so that we begin to consider those together. Those would be the three elements and some minor changes to the executive summary that's going to come at some point. In the cover sheet, I did have a projected schedule for this, holding a public hearing potentially on October 28th for all of the comp plan amendments. the text amendments, East Monroe, and the school mitigation fees potentially, and eventually coming to a recommendation in the first meeting in November for council with action planned by December 17th for final adoption. So there's going to be some fair amount of work in the next several weeks to bring this all together.
Okay. It can be a lot of work for the commission and to...
It is. We have...
through all of that documentation, is there a possibility that as soon as you have something that you can get it out to us?
Yes.
At that time?
Yes. We'll feed it out a piece at a time as they come to you, as far ahead as possible.
Okay. And we have to remember that a lot of people aren't like Commissioner Rodley and myself that don't have anything to do. But they are retired, so I appreciate getting into everybody as soon as possible. Commissioner Rodley.
Question on this housing for this, that they go back on. Would vacant, do we have any count on the vacant buildings and houses we have in the city right now? Would that have any effect on the housing, amount of units we're required to build up?
No, those are counted as, whether they're empty or occupied, they are counted as existing housing stock. What is, and that's aligned with projected population, then the difference between the available housing stock now and projected in the future, if there's a shortage of new units, that's where the issue comes together. You know, how short are we of capacity? But existing homes are all considered separately. And we don't have any hard data, at least not here in the city, as to how many existing units or, say, single-family homes out there are currently vacant.
Yeah.
Nor do we have a good handle at this point of how much of the commercial building space, not land, but building space, is vacant. There's been a fair amount of activity, so it certainly is less than it was 6 months or a year ago. We don't have any hard data. You've got to pull that together.
Would Jeff have anything on that?
No. Not currently.
All right. One question.
In this element, there's like around page, 20, 22, 23. There are some tables where we've not finished pulling in the residential acreage data from the 2012 Buildable Land Report. But in terms of residential on a more general level, the population projections are, there was not as much growth in the last, 8-10 years, no surprise, than was projected. When the 2007 report was done, Monroe was set to have a shortage of housing for 2025 of about 2,500 people, or about 1,000 units. Since that time, with the new 2012 report, we're going to finish pulling these numbers together, but the bottom line is that today we are about 1,800 people shy of capacity for what's projected, but our occupancy rate has gone up. It used to be about 2.5 people per household, and now it's, Monroe has, I think, the highest in the county at 2.9 people per household. So that translates to more than about 600 units rather than 1,000. And some of that is also offset by the subdivisions that have come online in the last few months. So we do still have a shortage of capacity, but it is quite a bit less, both due to ongoing development and lower actual population growth.
Okay.
was raised in Sweden. Need an airplane.
Well, to what you were just talking about, are there any assumptions in the modeling to figure out whether or not there's deficiencies in our ability to accommodate population that a certain amount of the land that was known to be vacant, potentially buildable, both in and out of the city limits and all of those within the growth area, of a certain amount of that land staying vacant for the choice of the owner, or is it assumed that all of the land that's inside the UGA has the potential to be built out as supply housing?
It's based on, that's a fairly arbitrary assumption. So it is based on development. It's the buildable areas are qualified in terms of subtractions for a net buildable area so that you get some more reliable numbers. But it does assume that, it doesn't assume, you know, a 10% vacant land as a constant. There would really be no good way to try and account for a number that would be meaningful.
Okay. I have a number of edits and questions, and rather than bore everybody to tears and distraction, would it be helpful if I just gave you this, or maybe spent 15 minutes with you?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Just, I don't think anything needs to be discussed.
Sure.
Here.
Sure.
So I'm just trying to save time and needs.
Okay. I can tell you that capacity is based on accounting for the land we have now and how it's zoned, but what it does include is an assumption that much of the land in the north area of the city, when I get this map up in through, where are we here? Pardon me for a minute. There we go. This would be North Kelso. Here's Chain Lake going up through here. Much of this area up here that is undeveloped is projected to be zoned R4 today. A lot of it is zoned R4, 4 units per acre. A lot of that land is on the assumption that it would be upzoned to something more like a 5 to 7 units per acre, a slight increase, which over the entire UGA area makes quite a difference in the potential capacity. So there is some upzoning to be considered in our 2015 update to accommodate that shortage.
So, Paul, would that most likely be a city-initiated comprehensive plan amendment?
Yes, as part of the update. Right. I do have. Oh, go ahead.
I have one comment on your saying. I appreciate you trying to be efficient and get your changes over the hall as quickly and easily as possible. My only question on that is would it be something that the rest of us need to hear or see or whatever? You know, if it's something that, you know, I could go through here and I have comments on it, you know, we could be ended up duplicating, is that a word?
Sure. Must be.
our efforts here. So that would be my only comment on that.
I think most of it is for details. I would like to know how many people are in prison, because one place it says 25, another 17, and maybe we need to get that exact number. Population of the prison.
Population of
the prison.
Prison.
Yeah. Oh. 2,400 was on their website today. Down from 25. Which I think we had in the projection here. I think I'm sure that number changes slightly up and down. In the past, their general capacity has been 2,500.
Thank you.
maybe some growth in their future. But I wanted to touch on commercial and industrial land area. I know that the question of commercial area has come up in the DEIS discussion about what I want to say is referrals to an abundance of land, available land for commercial development. And in fact, this is the vacant commercial land. I'm not talking about buildings, building space now, but the land. We have a total of about almost 58 acres of general commercial. Commercial, which includes professional office. Most of that, a large part of that, 34 acres, is in the North Kelsey area. Now, what that does not include, what we assumed as built or unavailable, is Walmart right here. It does include this piece of ground, which is about, it's either 7 or 11 acres, the northern third of the Walmart site. It also includes this area here, this is the landfill, which is about 11 acres, which is going to be mitigated for development. There's a possibility that there's at least one firm that may be interested in taking the land as is and decommissioning that landfill and clearing the site. The other option is that the city would take that on, make this piece of ground developable, and sell it as a buildable piece of ground. But 3 or 4 acres in North Kelsey includes a landfill. It also includes 6.5 acres here where the Snohomish PUD has purchased ground for a new district that it would relocate from their downtown location. That leaves about 17 acres available in the rest of the city. And most of that is in the mixed-use commercial zone, the western part of the West Main Corridor in through here. There is some service commercial at this interchange and a little bit of service commercial up around here of about 11 acres total. But what it comes down to is after you subtract out North Kelsey, which some fairly significant pieces of ground for development, and the mixed use, which as you can see has a couple of reasonable parcels potentially for commercial development or mixed use development, brings us down to a very few acres beyond that. So, let's say most of us here, scattered sites over the rest of the community through here and a little bit up on this corner, but there is no plethora of commercial land available. Now, what we have not done, and we're going to finish in this, is translating the demand based on the employment projections into land. With this much employment, how much of a shortage do we have a capacity for land? Should we be looking at expansion for more industrial, potentially more commercial ground? Now, in terms of can I stop there for a minute?
Commissioner Jansen? The couple of areas there in North Kelsey that you blocked out, you said there might be someone interested. At what point would you actually, is that one maybe the one behind Walmart?
This would be the landfill here.
Okay. What about, you were saying the one behind Walmart, was that one also you're taking off the block?
No, that's what we did not include in available vacant land was the
Walmart itself.
The Walmart site, their building site.
Okay.
They're submitting plans actually tomorrow for that project.
Is that closed? Did they close on
They did. They closed last Friday.
Okay.
Today is Monday. This morning the city received $7.08 million.
Cool.
Most of that goes to pay off the bonds, but there is some surplus.
So just that landfill was the one you were sort of excluding from what you say is left?
We excluded this from what's left.
Okay.
But this piece up here,
is available.
Is vacant and is counted in that total of 58 acres or 34 acres in North Kelsey. That's here, here. This is around the Providence, right here. Mm-hmm. This would be Lowe's. So there's quite a bit of ground here north of Tierney. It's got, what, four or five lots. And this discount tire is looking, I think, is about to pull the trigger out right about in this area.
The acreage that you get here then is for the GMA, or is that Monroe City Limits?
This is Monroe City Limits.
Okay. Because you were pointing at some of the stuff that's outside.
For residential, yes.
Yep.
But for commercial and industrial, there's a little bit of industrial out here.
And then up in the upper corner there. That's outside the city limits, right? On Highway 2.
That's right by the Jack in the Box.
Oh, here. That's in city limits.
That's in the city limits?
Yeah, this would be Frylands up through here, Roosevelt. There's Jack in the Box. Our city limits are just right out here.
Oh, okay. I thought, never mind.
Between this piece of service commercial and this piece and here, it's about 11 acres.
Okay.
I was just kind of trying to understand at what point do you decide that you've taken the landfill out of the availability equation because somebody's interested?
No, it's part of the total. We're considering it as vacant and available.
Okay.
Whether it's available as a landfill site or a ready-to-build site, it is available.
I thought I heard you saying it was not part of that total. Misunderstood.
Mr. Sherman, as a note, Paul, this document says that the block plant is considered vacant for purposes of...
Yes, it does. So it does.
You may want to...
This note, actually... Oh, it does show up in this map.
It just needs some color.
Yeah, this is the... I think this is the welcome process.
That's not welcome to me.
Right. Yeah. Okay. The figures do include the block plant as vacant, since it's basically a condemned building that's on that property. And that's about 7 acres.
Okay. That's going to have to be built in with the building.
In terms of industrial.
Well, I know why it didn't show up as vacant, because we were using Island County Assessor's data, and if it had a code that was undeveloped/vacant is what we were utilizing. So because there's a building on it right now, it's not showing up in the Island County Assessor's as technically undevelopable and vacant. So we can add it into the map.
There apparently been some accuracy problems in the past in this comp plan, and the beauty of this GIS software is that it gives you a good operator, generates very good math. I'm not the operator. Calling it out right now. This would be industrial. We have, in terms of land, again, about 22 and a half acres of industrial ground. The only general industrial we have is north of the far north Kelsey, the Lakeside operation. But in terms of light industrial, we have about 15 acres in the Frylands. That's all the land. I believe Canyon Creek owns this parcel here, but there are a few parcels there, and that's basically it. Let me think here. The slide is a little bit shy of the entire area.
It's zoomed in a little bit.
There's some industrial ground further south, but pretty limited capacity for industrial ground.
Paul? The county gave the city what is it, a gas station across from Violet there?
Here? The Shell?
Across the APM.
Oh, right here?
Yeah. Between there and the airport, there's a piece of property right there that's swamp. The county gave us that property years ago to hold forever and not develop. But to make a day when that property might be available, like the dairy farm out there where you can fill it in and use it. It's very soft out there. And I understand there's a bulldozer somewhere buried underneath out there, too. We've had to pull airplanes out of that swamp. And it's up to your waist almost in swamp. But that I don't know if that area could be developed immensely or not.
Oh, here?
Yep.
Well, there's some restrictions on that in terms of the airport operations, of course. And you're right, the county did, I believe we used grant money in the acquisition of that ground with the county. But if the airport expands and takes some of that, there would have to be an in-kind trade or some kind of reimbursement, I believe, back to the county from that program. That's really about some of the things I wanted to cover. There are still some numbers to be aligned between this and the bill of land reports, more detail to bring in so that it's going to flow better and lead to the logical conclusion that here's what we have, here's the projections, here's the capacity. So that'll give us a good basis for trying to figure out what to do for the next. For the update for the next 20 years.
Okay. Commissioners, any other discussion on the comprehensive plan?
You mentioned Island County, I assume you mentioned that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm looking at it. Thank you for the question. Yeah, and I suppose I should put a disclaimer a little bit on this map and the previous map, and is that these are technically just using the Snohomish County Assessor's data and doing a straightforward pass of what's coded right now as developed, undeveloped and vacant, as opposed to ground truthing, field verifying, aerial verifying, which takes quite a bit more time. And the buildable lands report is something totally different, where you look at what infill potential there is to redevelop. And that, when you start comparing these, you'll see this map is just straightforward, what's vacant right now, what's listed as vacant under Snohomish County Assessor's.
One question, Melissa. On this one here, that block plant, would that show up on vacant industrial property, or because that property is,
I think it's service commercial right now. Isn't that zone service commercial for the block plant? I believe so. It's not industrial.
Yes.
That's not industrial.
It doesn't show up as vacant because there's a building.
Service commercial.
Technically, the county is still counting as
block plant and service commercials.
I'm sure that plan was right before the zoning.
Yeah. Well, we can add it into the map, though.
Yeah, I was just curious as to which, if it was service commercial, then that's
moved. That building was put up for cabbing to
We can add it to the commercial map, how's that? That's a good idea.
Okay, so Paul, you said you get us the changes as soon as you can on this, so we can start pouring through it. And it looks like we don't have any other comments or questions at this time.
The only comment I have is when we started this comprehensive plan, and when the Growth Management Act first started, we hired three planners, and we had to work with the county on the first one we did, which was very interesting because we didn't get along with the county at all back in the day. I don't know what the
careful now we have a Snohomish County in the audience.
Yeah. Technically, is the Snohomish County now? Actually,
It's all right. Well, I'm on the goals.
Wait. I'm on go.
Boy, what was that?
The 90.
I was on the Scottish County tomorrow.
95?
Or 80 something?
80.
85 or something like that.
7, something like that.
Yeah.
Long time.
Yeah, I'm back. Okay. Okay, except for Commissioner Sherwood's changes, then I guess that's all we have.
Bring it.
Thank you, Paul. All right, then the next item, workshop item we have is the ZCA 2012-04 Monroe Municipal Code Chapter 18.80 Sign Code Amendment. I can't believe this is back. I guess it's here for the interim. I guess there's still something we have to discuss on this, right?
There is.
All right.
Back in April, after we worked through here with the commission, the council did adopt interim regulations, 6 months, for a couple of reasons. One was to allow us collectively to find any tweaks or missing regulations that we'd like to come back and change. And the other was to have a 6-month grace period where business owners have time to undo or get their arms around this revised sign code, because there will be some impacts. It expires in late October, so we will be bringing this back to you next meeting, and I believe most of the changes are going to be pretty minor, and I'm hoping that it's something that we can do in one session. But so we need to adopt permanent regulations. We could adopt them as they are, but there are a few tweaks that we're putting out there for consideration. And once we do adopt the permanent regulations, there will be enforcement. Things like A-board and sandwich signs there's going to be some pretty active enforcement on that. Banners, more in terms of temporary signs. And if you recall, if you have an illegal sign, you have, I think it was 5 years, and it could be extended to 7 years before you would have to legalize your illegal sign, change it to so that's conforming.
Those are permanent signs.
Right, permanent
signs. You mean like grandfathered in?
Yeah.
So they're permanent signs that may be illegal under this code,
right,
will be safe for at least 5 years, if not 7.
Okay.
And I think there are very few that would qualify for that. But we've only received one comment in all this time, and that was your attachment from the subway owner who wanted to have some ability to post banners off the building on the property. Or you could say, for example, in some cases, hanging on a fence on the property. And that's one of the things that this is the first one, actually, nice segue. On the back side of the cover sheet, the second page, are some issues that we had collected or seen ourselves and bring for some consideration. So I wanted to touch on these and get some reaction. The first one of these banners. Right now, banners are allowed on the facade of the building, period. So there are a number of violations, and we've had lots of problems with banners. And the request or the direction for that would be to have some flexibility and allow, if I own a business, I can place a banner, say, in the front yard, or if there's a fence along the side street of my property, I can hang a banner on the fence, and there are some of those out there today, as to whether we should entertain that as opposed to limiting it to what it is now, which is a banner on the facade, on the building wall, not in sight anywhere. If anyone has any specific reactions, I'd be happy to hear them.
Commissioner Shirley.
Those things that look like parasails that you stick in the ground, is that
flags? Those will be illegal.
That's a flag or a banner.
Okay. they're not allowed. The problem is that they're done without a permit, and there's questionable safety, you know,
if
how
you
are they...
visibility when you're pulling out of the dress.
How are they placed? I like the color, but...
Somebody's been selling that out. They're all over the place.
Commissioner Dirksen?
As far as the banner signs, would there be a limited time where they can hang them on their building or put them on their yard?
We do have limitations on time now. I believe it's up to 60 days, but then it has to be taken down for at least 60 days. Or if it's 30 days, it has to be taken down for 30 days. And that sort of thing, it's hard to enforce, but we're going to put together an enforcement tracking system.
Personally, for the banners that I see on the buildings, I would like to see a time that is allowable while they are getting a sign designed for their building or something, and then they have to be removed, because I think it's really unprofessional looking for the company just to do that. I think there needs to be some stricter regulations on that, and not that they can take it down for 30 days and then put it back up again for another 60 days. That's my opinion.
There are businesses that have done in the past and used the banner as a temporary sign, mm-hmm. for like an opening and so forth, and then it was replaced with a permanent. There are a handful of cases where the banner has become a permanent sign.
I can think of that example.
By default. And that's one thing we're trying to avoid.
Commissioner Tull?
I would be careful though, because Canyon Creek put up a big banner that said they're hiring, so they might need to take it down and then they might need to put it back up.
Right. Well, and those types of signs is a different issue, but
communicating something other than the name of a business.
Right.
And the reason for considering this change is that based on that one letter, or because I think what he was saying is some building fronts aren't visible from the road, which is why they'd want to put it on a fence.
Well, I think what he's looking for, he does have visibility at that location on Highway 2. There's visibility to Highway 2. All you have to turn ahead of time to reach the business. I think he's done this in the past, is just put a banner out actually at the sidewalk so they can see it as you're heading east. And you make the decision before you get there.
So they're using the banner as an alternative to a gate.
Yes.
I wouldn't really be in favor of changing that for that purpose. Yeah.
It's a good point. It's basically a large A board in the form of a banner.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be changing that. I could understand if, to make it fair, if there's businesses that have a building front and they're going to put a banner up for some reason, and then there's a business that doesn't have a visible building front, they need to put it on a fence. But I was trying to think of where that might be the case.
Well, we've had a case a couple of times where a certain business, which I won't name, but that does not have visibility on Highway 2, has hung a banner off their property.
On the fence? I wouldn't want to see that as just a way around the A board rule. So
The only comment I have on banners, Paul, is that they should be professional. You know, not somebody taking their garage with a magic marker and making banners. And the other thing is they have to be properly affixed to something and not waving in the breeze. So those would be the only comments I have on banners, because I see a lot of banners that they're really ugly and at halftime can't read them because they're wrapped around.
If you add that to the rule that's already in place for the interim?
I would like to have something to that effect so that people know that if they put up a banner, they can't just put up anything.
The last bullet point talks about all signs being professional.
Okay.
So-called professional.
And as far as the banner being affixed properly, you know, tied down.
Right. We do have that in the regs, but it's not always enforced. In the past, there hasn't been active enforcement. We've enforced on record to complaints. And we've also held off during these last several months pending the adoption of permanent regulations, which also gives us time to try and figure out how we're going to do this enforcement. We still haven't quite figured it out. But there, you know, that is intended to be a distinct point in time that here on enforcement is underway, and it's across the board.
Commissioner Jansen?
So, of course, I came this late. I didn't get to participate in the first round. If I understand this correctly, this ordinance also covers residences trying to hold garage sales. Is that correct? And the signage that they would use to point people to their garage sales.
The banner you're talking about?
No, just general signs. And another comment about signage in general.
I think that's
covered.
Right. But the question I had was under 18.80.050, temporary and special use signs, I believe that would be the part covering garage sale signs.
Page 33.
I think you're right. The cannot be permanently affixed to the ground or located on a utility pole, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But in practice, we don't directly enforce garage sale signs. We do go after signs that don't get picked up or are out of date, but we haven't made a conscious effort to go out and collect garage sale signs.
Whether garage sale or other temporary uses, the concern I have is that option 2 says that signs must be of a sufficient weight and stature to ensure that they remain in place during high winds. But then option 3 says that the signs cannot be permanently affixed to the ground, like including staking, or obviously those utility poles. Like, don't have a problem not using the utility poles. But if we don't allow you to stake it to the ground or some other permanent slash temporary permanent fixture, it's not going to remain in place during high winds. So
paper signs do.
Okay, but I guess that kind of limits. You know, most people doing, you know, garage sales or the car washes or whatnot, maybe they don't have the
politics or
whatnot. So I just wonder how important it is to have including staking, or could we take that out and allow someone to stake a sign that's temporary?
I don't think the political ones can, because that's
freedom of speech.
Okay. Yeah.
But they can't be placed on our medias. There is an ordinance. We would pass that a long time ago. You can't place a political sign on the media.
Right. If you're not supposed to put political signs within the right of way.
We can, that's okay with me. But then,
yeah, just,
let's just stick with the.
I know. It just felt like the one thing I felt like was a little bit of a conflict here to put people in a really difficult position to satisfy both. How do we get remove the including staking
part? Yeah. Commissioner
Rodman? There is one thing that I noticed we haven't enforced as strongly as we should have, and that's businesses who left and leave their signs down on the windows for years. Downtown has got a whole bunch of them.
Monroe Monitor is one.
Yeah.
That's late.
Yes. And we've been waiting to, it actually is in our code, our old sign code also. And part of our enforcement is going to be removing signs that are no longer valid. Even the monitor sign has some historic value, but nonetheless, it needs to come down.
So do you need input on the bullets, or are you just going over them?
The bullets specifically, and if you have come up with any other things, we could certainly add to the list to be considered.
Well, can we just go through the bullets first, then?
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought we were going to the bullets here, and we got sidetracked. Okay.
So mixed use, we don't have a maximum amount of signage on property. If I was there, it would be basically controlled by the size of the parcel, but we had one business that has a fair amount of signage on it, and a couple, there were a few people that questioned whether that was legal, and it was. So I think we'd like to put a cap to prevent a too much signage in the mixed-use neighborhood, and where the properties are smaller, the scale of the buildings is smaller, so we don't have a high level of signage for one property.
And it's hard for me to believe that we went through all of that and didn't have an actual signage.
I thought we went back and forth with that.
I think we did go back and forth.
I think it was touched on. I thought it was in there.
Mm-hmm. I did too in that picture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was
where you showed all of the blocks where they could have signs. You know, I thought for sure that was
in there. Maybe that was just downtown.
No, it was more general.
Was it?
Yeah.
I just remember that.
We're going to fix that.
Good.
The third one, actually, back to banners. My personal opinion is, I don't really want to see banners proliferating in the yards. Permanent signs for other uses, like churches in residential zones. Right now, in fact, there's the same problem in Snohomish, where I live, where a church wants to put up a modified sign, and they're busting the regulations. But that we allow for permanent signs for uses like churches, things that do happen in residential zones. Right now, they technically can't do it.
Like what these of churches?
Like daycare?
Oh, sorry.
You mean like a daycare?
Commissioner Tuttle.
Like what besides churches are we talking about?
Well, actually, it's funny you said that because that thought's just going through my head. This is not for permanent sign for businesses in residential areas because that would be a home occupation, not a standalone business.
So what else besides a church would be?
Church, some other public use, community center, or semi-public use. But I don't see private business
daycare
being allowed to do permanent signs, like a daycare center. I think they're allowed a very small home occupation type identification sign.
Like take the next step or something like that would be? That's in a residential area.
I think it's probably on a case by case. That might be awesome. Yeah. But what triggered it was the idea of churches. Churches are allowed in virtually any zone by right.
I think Commissioner Tuttle's right, because I think in a sense where you're going is you got to be careful what.
I think we would need to specify.
Or you say only churches can do it, and then you get all sorts of problems with that.
Maybe I just can't think of what what the possibilities would be.
So yeah, I think
community center.
Yeah, I think that's what we have to watch out for, because we may get an application for something that we're not even aware, and then all of a sudden, how do we process it if it's not allowed under that zone? So a notation that says for these uses. And this came up for an example because we did have a church that submitted an application for in a residential zone.
Could it be under special circumstances? A comment or something to say, we have, I'm not sure how you would put it, but you could, like a...
any non-residential use in a residential zone?
Yeah, well, not any non-residential use, but what I'm saying is what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a non-conforming.
Legal non-conforming.
Something to like that, what I'm saying. Melissa, do you kind of understand where I'm going there?
I think we can take a step. We can take a look at and see what uses we think there are in residential zones, and kind of where it might fit in. Like Paul's saying, maybe for businesses it doesn't make sense, but churches, daycares.
You think it's like a special permit or
conditional use?
Conditional use, yeah. That's the word I was looking for, conditional.
Well, something like, you know, like maybe a skate park. They want to put up a permanent sign for the skate park in a residential area.
Could
do that.
Well, would there be a skate park in a residential area?
Sure, could be.
Yeah.
A mini skate park. Neighborhood skate, or a neighborhood park.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, like a park, but they already have signs.
Like a private park.
The private parks have signs, though. Don't they? I just want it to be defined.
Yeah, I think you still should go through the process to make sure that, you know, it's okay to put that sign there. And you're not going to have the residents in the area, you know, saying, you know, we got signs going up there.
Mary Kay,
was illumination, and being concerned about whether a sign would be illuminated at night.
Oh, well,
that's a really big concern.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll look forward to some more info on that.
Awning signage is now, I want to say you cannot do signage on awnings. This is a case that was triggered by a couple places in the industrial park. That wanted to can utilize our awnings for potential science purposes. And I think, you know, carefully done might be okay. But they still have a maximum that, you know, that we had one business, I think, that was busting the maximum even without the awning allowance.
What about these vehicle vans that park and named up on the highway too? With the businesses on the side, painted all inside the vans, park those up there.
That's tricky, and I think we do have some regulations that address a van or a truck as advertising on a regular basis. You know, it's not to say that you can't park your truck there sometime and so forth, but if it's there all the time as a sign. That one, we're not going to let you get away with it anymore. number of signs for building with multiple facades. Right now, it's a little, well, it's much clearer than it used to be, but basically you can sign the primary facade of your building, which really calls related to the main entrance. And the only case where you can put a sign on the side of a building is if it's a, quote, secondary pedestrian facade, meaning next to a pedestrian path or perhaps a, you know, a vacant access or something. And we've had a couple cases where we've done them. We've stretched the definition of pedestrian facade. The battery store downtown has a sign on the side of the building on Main Street, East Main. But
does their building turn a corner?
No, it doesn't turn a corner, but it's on a. There's a key bank is right next door. There's some space and a parking area. We got creative with that one, but there are other cases where where there may be a multi-tenant building. Or a single tenant building, for that matter, that has a primary facade, let's say a side facade on to a neighboring street, or, you know, Highway 2, for example. If they have an east-facing facade with the front door, they cannot necessarily put a sign on the side of the building. There's some restrictions about that, and we thought we might loosen that up somewhat to potentially allow signs on more than one facade. And they'll still have a site maximum that they can't exceed. Although those maximums tend to be fairly generous.
Commissioner Jensen?
So, for example, Fred Meyer, I'm not sure if they there now or not. They do have a door on the west side, as well as their couple of doors that essentially face south. So would they be, the west side, there's no pedestrian in a sense. It's all parking lot. Would they be permitted to have a sign above that door on that side of the building?
Most likely.
And then another example, it doesn't, they close now to Eddie's. Would that have been considered a sign or billboard on the side of their building?
Only the space that said Eddie's. The rest of it was art. Mural.
Okay. Yeah. But even the fact that it said Eddie's, would that have been
just the
permitted
space
or not permitted?
It was just the space that said Eddie's.
Right. But being it was not on the facade side, would that have been a problem?
Counted against their total signage.
Right, but I'm talking about the fact that it was on his own facade side. Would this be blocking that if we didn't change that?
I don't think so.
And I think we have to be careful with this. You know, for example, on the Lake Tai building, we've had requests in the past for an interior tenant to put a sign on the Freilands Boulevard face of that building, which could multiply into 15 different tenant signs on the, it'd be the side facing Freilands. Since I have no way of advertising, if I'm at a doctor's office in the middle of the building, I have no way of getting an outside signs. I don't have any frontage. But, you know, it's, there's, we don't want to open the door too far so that signage really starts to proliferate on a building.
So does that not fall under the property owner's responsibility if he has multiple tenants that they would put a freestanding sign with, you know, that's
right.
Available for that?
We have, you know, allowances for multi-tenant signs. For ID for the businesses.
Yeah.
And sometimes that space is used up. And on Highway 2, and maybe, I'm not sure if Bridget, if it's a problem at the Singer Shopping Center, Monroe.
Yeah, well.
That where there's an anchor
banner
that takes up a certain amount of area, and there's only slots for three more. And if I get there before you, you may not have a space, but that's a tenant owner
thing. Yeah.
Issue.
I would think that would be.
And there's, you know, there's the measured areas already. I think a strip mall already anticipates that.
Right.
But like, it would be nice to have a sign on the other side where Stretch Street, and I don't know if that's allowable.
It could potentially be allowed in this. Maybe
or like the mattress store, but we covered the mattress store having two street fronts. Yeah, mm-hmm. So if it's a street front, I guess train tracks don't count as a street front.
Would it be appropriate for this type of ordinance in the case of a multi-tenant situation where we would essentially almost require that if they're going to have a multi-tenant sign, they must provide space for all of their tenants?
That can be tricky. A building might have, you might have, a 10,000 square foot building, and you might have one tenant that takes up 8,000 square feet. So there's only two or three tenants, as opposed to you might have 20 tenants in that same 10,000 square foot building. So there's really no way to, I think, to allow how much on our part to judge for what needs to be set up.
And the way buildings are, you know, these strip malls are set up today is you could have, you know, five businesses one day and then
right.
Two businesses the next
right.
Day because
changes
combining
constantly.
Combining space.
Opening walls.
Yeah, opening walls.
And, yeah. And I know in the Whitfield building there's some two or three tenants inside the building,
mm-hmm.
Common entrance. One common entrance.
Yeah.
I think the licensing place and two or three other businesses that you don't have any signage available because they don't have a frontage space to the frontage.
I think a lot of places now what they do is they put enough where they, you know, the maximum allowed in that area.
too, is that if you want front space, you pay higher rent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of between a business and a landlord.
More so
that
between.
Involves the city.
Right. I don't want the city to get involved in tenant-landlord disagreements. Number of wall signs per property. What was that one? Do you recall?
Well, I think when you look at our code, this says there are certain districts that say general commercial, it says number of signs, and it just says one. And there's wall signs. There's
right.
Sometimes where a tenant or a business wants more than one wall sign, and that goes with the number of facades. They're sort of interlinked in that it's. We've had a couple of occasions where there's an interpretation that when you look at the code, it seems very strict, and it just looks like you can only have one wall sign. Where judgment says it seems to make sense, you could have up to two, maybe three, depending on the number of facades you have. So I think we need to define that a little bit better about how we interpret number of wall signs.
I agree. I'm confused as to what's the difference between a wall sign and any other sign. What's on the wall?
Well, it gets pretty, the signage is pretty, it comes down to definitions in the very beginning of the sign code, but at wall signs, technically, when it's mounted on the wall of
okay.
the facade, and then you've got banners that can be, attached to the wall, and you've got various other types of signage, but it's freestanding signs and pole signs.
And I'm pretty sure that was already, we're talking about all the drawings that we went through, showing what could be where, and I thought that was pretty well.
I think this is kind of related to the earlier discussion about other facades. I think that's they're almost the same thing in some ways.
Okay, so some of these could be
maybe they could be collapsed.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. That's where I'm getting confused. Thank you.
Small freestanding signs for community events. We've had things come up a couple of times, like for Little League or local basketball tournament. There actually was a banner on a fence on Highway 2 that we took down that was for a 3-on-3 basketball tournament in Arlington. But in the past, we've asked people to just give us a map where they'd like to put these signs, just a general indication where they go out and stick in the, for Little League sign up, for example. It's a community event, community-driven, and we don't want to disallow the ability to advertise those kind of things. Just a little clarifying language for that. And this next one, the off-premise signs, whether we should consider a distance, how far away from the closest major intersection can I be? Let's say Kelsey and Highway 2, for example. I could theoretically be half a mile away from that intersection and have my name displayed on an off-premise sign, business ABC. I can't, it's not an advertisement. If an off-premise sign on Highway 2 would have the names of the businesses off-premise and an arrow, and that's it. But we're questioning whether there needs to be a maximum distance for that. Galaxy Theater is one of the places that drove this idea of off-premise signs on Highway 2 because they have no visibility. Some of the smaller businesses, Red Robin can do that, I suppose. They don't have any direct visibility on Highway 2. They can be part of a multi-tenant sign.
Well, I thought we talked about doing those.
But question is, should we qualify maximum distance, 300 feet or 500 feet or 1,000 feet? Or
well, if we don't, I can think of a couple right now that were on Main Street that I saw on the thoroughfare for going up on Highway 2. If we don't do some limiting, people go, okay, there's no limitation. I can take my sandwich sign and set it out here as long as it's not. Is that what that is?
Freestanding?
No. This would be a permanent.
Oh, permanent.
Permanent sign.
Like a galaxy.
Permanent multi-tenant identification. It's a lot of syllables. A sign that has a permanent naming of businesses. Like on in front of what was it, AutoZone, could be a fairly large identification for Galaxy Theaters, and also where some other, there could be Walmart listed on that multi-tenant sign, and some smaller businesses, the Subway up there.
I think it should be some kind of a business set. What that is, I don't know. I think you guys could probably get an idea of what that business is.
We should do an exercise on a map and try some different scales to see how it fits.
I could see people saying, well, I have a business 5 miles out of town. I'd like to have that on that sign. Well, who wouldn't, Then we'd have signs everywhere pointing to signs,
They don't even point.
I have a business down in Linwood that I'd like to help people in Monroe to go to.
That's exactly where this is coming from, because we have had a couple of requests for signs in place for things that are 5 miles, 3 miles away, or the signing for Arlington, et cetera. So
I can see a problem coming up in the near future with Walmart. They're going to want to sign down there somewhere.
Yeah. I'm sure they will. They would like to have an ID sign. It's got to be a very straightforward, simple identification, nothing fancy. Wall Drugs, great example, were far off premise.
Yeah.
I think they're all over the world.
Well, yeah, it's like in Snohomish, there's that on the side of Highway 2, there's that signage right in the middle of a field that says Kohl's, and it looks ridiculous. Yeah, it just looks ridiculous. Right, but I'm saying it's so far away from the premise that I don't want to see anything ridiculous like that out in the middle of the field.
That's quite a stretch. Yeah. I'm not sure how effective it is. I'd be curious to know how many people have actually been
It just looks silly. So you have Walmart and Galaxy, and everybody goes in on it, some big sign, and they put it out on 203 somewhere. out in the field.
Put it at the bridge.
So I think that is a good idea, but you guys have to figure out what the...
Yeah, I know we've had this discussion about, directional. They're more directional sign now.
Right.
Business.
Directional is the correct word. Yeah.
So, and I know we've had that discussion, it's just that we didn't discuss, how far...
Right.
Down the street.
Right.
Can we allow them to put a sign up there?
Sure.
Walmart's going to be the furthest one from Highway 2, and I'm sure they're going to want to have something out there. Work a deal with a number of other businesses back there.
They'll probably put
a sign up there. And have to put a sign out there.
The landfill site would be a good example, too. Fairly isolated. That might... it might be worth my while to get my name right out on Highway 2. Mm-hmm. It has to be part of a larger sign. I think just a minimum of 3.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, we talked
about it. Okay. Good. Limit on the number of illuminated signs per business. We've had a couple that seem to be push the question of whether this is too much, not in terms of just signage, but in terms of illuminated signage.
Example.
Lit.
Can you give an example?
Was it in the industrial park that we had that one? Yeah, I want to say like Clearview. Potentially was going to have quite a bit of illuminated.
The wine and spirits?
Signage, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I believe, I don't think there are any regulations now for whether or not, that I don't think there's any restriction on illuminated, that you can light, if I have 5 signs, I can illuminate all of them. And maybe we're, just being a little too picky here.
Inside a building or attached to the building or freestanding? Does it matter?
Exterior signs.
It's all any combination of them?
Yeah.
As dark as the weather is in this part of the country, I think.
I'm thinking of a bar, too, that has, like, you know, 12 beer lights, and you don't want to not let them have that. It's kind of a thing.
It's illuminated, and so it's anything. It's not just a light shining on it, but it could be self-illuminated, like neon or something, even, or...
And that gets into the issue of how many signs. I guess if we didn't have too many signs, then illuminating maybe wouldn't be that much of a problem. No more handwritten signs. I can think of A boards in particular.
Oh yeah, the A boards.
It. I don't think it does. I don't think it does the business much good. It doesn't present a very professional image for the business. But we're not trying to regulate taste, and we don't regulate the content and the taste of the sign. We feel that signs should be prepared by some kind of professional, so that it is a good quality product that's got the stability and it doesn't look like somebody just hit it with a crane. It's not a big problem. But.
I guess I have a question on whether you want to consider that for both permanent and temporary signs or just permanent. I guess I would ask the planning commission. Both. What's your preference?
Well, if we say temporary signs, that again we're going to go back to the garage sale signs.
Yeah. Oh, but banners aren't permanent and A boards aren't permanent, so we want to cover those.
Right. So I don't know anybody who does a garage sale that's going to be able to get a professional sign.
Well, yeah, you buy them at the dollar store.
Maybe there's exceptions under that particular.
They all look the same.
Yeah, maybe garage sales would be exceptions.
I can see making sure that you don't put a cardboard box out there with a sign on it, so it rolls down the street and gets in the flat car or whatever. As far as temporary signs, I think as long as they're legible and readable.
Temporary includes banners and A boards, though.
I think garage sale signs is kind of an unintended consequence of that rule. Maybe we can find a way to accept.
Can we do an exception just for the garage sale signs and all the other temporary signs have to be professionally done?
I'm not sure there are any other temporary signs that would be handwritten.
But you don't put it in. Somebody will stick a sheet up somewhere with handwritten letters and say, well, you didn't say. So you've got to be specific.
Commissioner Tully?
Just one quick question. Do we ever, when people do painting in their windows instead of, does window painting count as signage?
It would.
So if someone...
Technically. Yeah.
Okay. I just know there's a lot of window painting that goes on around here, and sometimes people have a blank window and then they have their name of their business painted in the window, but that's not necessarily professionally printed. They might do it themselves sometimes, so I don't know if we need to, I don't want to unintentionally put her in out of business.
I'm thinking the candy store, too.
Well,
that's more mural, my day.
It can be, but I think she has her business name painted in the window there, too.
Yeah. So do you want to make that an exception? Is that what I'm hearing?
I don't know. I just wasn't sure what the definition of the permanent sign was. I can be done. I just wanted to ask that question. You guys can look into it.
And a window sign would be not be a permanent sign necessarily.
Okay.
And
unless it's her business name painted, it needs to be professional.
And she hires someone to do it, so that makes
sense. Yeah, but sometimes they can be
versus somebody taking a paintbrush and putting their name on a window, you know, type thing. Something like that. And they have to be able to do it professionally. If they get it professionally, that's fine.
There was one, also, line item, I think you missed, to clarify signage regulations along scenic highways.
Yes.
I'm not sure where that came from.
We have
The Lewis Street and Highway 2 are part of the scenic highway system, but it's very confusing. The DOT Scenic Vista Code is DOT had a hard time interpreting it, but basically it is not necessarily applied or enforced within city limits. Now, Highway 2 is a scenic highway, but obviously in a urban area like Monroe, Highway 2 is not a scenic vista corridor, not a scenic highway. So the regulations are not universally applied within those zones, but that's not explicit in the regulations. So after lots of hair pulling with ourselves and Tom Beck with our consultant and DOT folks, we ended up with the language that we have in the code. It's one of those things that could use a little bit of clarification if it's possible to do so. Because if you strictly read the code, it doesn't sound very friendly at all.
Okay.
So we need to find a way to soften that so that it doesn't make me think that it precludes me from doing anything within the scenic corridor. It's a tough one. I'm trying to adjust that.
Will it forward to your wordsmith?
Pardon me?
Will it forward to your wordsmith?
Yes, me too.
Well, what that did in my mind, it brought up something that I thought, I don't know if we addressed it or not, I can't remember, but using things like a vehicle, putting it up on top of the pole, and just using that vehicle as a sign, or, you know, putting a bunch of tires on the pole,
right.
Saying that's
we did talk about
tire
that.
Business.
Yeah.
You know, is there anything that says, you know, avoid that? You have to have a sign that says what your business is rather than...
I think we were allowing
I
think we were.
Yeah,
just if it had something to do with the business.
On a scenic highway?
Oh, well, on a scenic highway.
Yeah. You know,
that's where it came from. I saw that on a scenic highway. I said, I wouldn't mind.
Design guidelines have some examples of like sculptural pieces, figures that effectively advertise the business, you know, like somebody holding a mug of beer, a figure holding a mug of beer.
But on a scenic highway, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Is that appropriate? Yeah, even if it's within the city limits.
Yeah, that might be a regular temple. That might be subject to regulation, something like that.
I think that's where you could maybe mess up the line and use it as a warning to run. Just an idea.
Okay. I was going to add one quick comment on the last point before we moved on about the requiring that it's a sign to be professional. Would it be appropriate to say that if it's a business with a business license, their signage must be professional, where if it's not something with a business license, like your homeowner with a garage sale or the school building, a car wash, that it could be hand drawn.
Yeah. It could be something like that. I'm sure Paul and could come up with some.
Any attention.
We can look at that. I would like to look at other jurisdictions and communities and see how they address it too.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. It's always good to do a little bit of plagiarism.
Yes.
It is really subjective, as you can tell. It could be subjective if we don't limit it.
And I didn't mention, in case you missed it, in the cover sheet, after the council did pass those the interim regulations, we sent a postcard to every business in town that had a business license. It was like a couple thousand postcards. And so everybody got the word. So if you're operating without a business license, you didn't get the word. Sarah Pizza.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So we covered most all the businesses out there, and we really got no response. I think a lot of people didn't seem to think it would affect them.
Okay. So. Well, our building owner did take down all the temporary signs and order permits, so it helped somebody.
That's good. That's good. Just be nice to everybody. Okay, anything else, Paul, on the signage?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, Paul, you have one question on signage. If you put up a new sign, you have to have a new permit?
Yes. If there may be cases where you have an existing sign and you're just replacing the fascia or the wording, but you still have to have a permit.
Mine's about 50 years old. I got to change it.
I was thinking about that today when you said it was 1970. The sign looks like it's been that long too, but you know, it has a historic patina. Yeah.
Okay. All right, then we'll move on to discussion by commissioners and staff.
Staff?
I don't think I have very much. Anyway, I mentioned Walmart that it closed Friday. Mm-hmm. East Monroe, East Environmental Impact Statement comments are due this Friday. What else is going on? H3O has gotten, the Corps of Engineers has finished their review on the H3O project, and they're not going to put any other restrictions on the requirements for permitting on that project. So they and now they're looking at a early spring opening. They've kind of backed off a bit since it's so late in the year. It's going to be difficult getting things started now.
Five Brothers is going to start their business.
Yeah. Yeah, Five Guys.
When are they coming?
They were tied to the Walmart closing, and Walmart's going to open tentatively in the fall of next year. So I'm sure Five Guys is going to happen before that. I can see them opening by next summer.
But
the Walmart opening is going to trigger a lot more interest in businesses, business space up there. Yeah.
Okay. Just one quick question. Did you hear any more about this dam? The Snohomish PUD dam down in the sky?
No.
No?
Not, okay.
Just
not
curious as if that's got anywhere. No. Okay. Commissioner Jensen? Commissioner Tuttle? Commissioner Rattle? Commissioner Dirksen? Commissioner Sherwood?
Yes. I hate to do this, dude. One of the things I was concerned about YouTube and workflow. Are you okay? Or is it just too much? So is there a solution in process?
In the near term, no. With Dave, this is Dave's last hurrah tonight. We weren't sure he would be here this long, but he has been working, 12-hour days this past week? Mm-hmm. Full-time with the county and part-time here. We are going to refill Dave's position at halftime. It's funded this year and into next year. We're also looking to get a funding in next year's budget for a full-time position in the plan permitting. So short term, we have to deal with it, and we're coming up against some deadlines that we've got to meet. But long term, yeah, it's. I think it seems. I'm fairly confident that we will come into this budget with an authorization for another full-time position next year. Yeah. It'll help a lot.
But to piggyback on the Commissioner Sherwood's question, I think as far as the schedule that we have today, you know, as far as our agenda for this year, do you think that needs to be adjusted, or are you guys...
It's challenging. But what we're facing is, needing to get this through the process this calendar year for the comp plan amendments.
I think what I was getting at is if there's something in regards to what we're doing that can wait so that you can hit any more immediate issues. Because, you have the draft environmental effects that now you're going to have Walmart. You have the subdivisions and so on and so forth. So I just want to say I'm willing to, back off of something if there is something that's flexible to allow you more time to do that, which is more important.
Yeah. Right.
So I wasn't sure if a prioritization was placed upon you by the city manager or the mayor. I don't know how it works. But I just wanted to say I think we should be willing as a commission to let some of this stuff wait if it can wait so that you can get to the more immediate issues that are more pressing so that you are not in here working when you should not be in here working.
Something more positive.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that and thank you for that. In reality, there are things like the sign code has to be addressed since it's going to take some time to put that together. Actually, marijuana regulations are going back to council for permanent adoption. That has to happen. That's a little more flexibility. That's not until December, but nonetheless needs to be addressed. But mostly it has to do with the comp plan amendments that we've got going here with the text amendments and East Monroe. East Monroe has been taking quite a bit of staff time. There's going to be another heavy-duty period of that, when we get these comments in pace in ourselves, having to get that process within a couple of weeks. But I don't know if there's much that we can really back off in terms of bringing here. This is a big one. This land use element has been a challenge, taking much more time than we figured, but not surprising.
Okay. And my second thing was I did want to congratulate Mr. McCollum. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, that's all for me.
Yeah, we'll miss you.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll see you. And I just wanted to say one real quick thing. I've really enjoyed working with everybody here, and I really appreciate several of you at various different times have given me some good advice and I followed up on it. So thank you very much. It's been fun being here, and if you ever need help, I'll come back as a volunteer.
Okay, cool.
Be careful what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
Can you come to next week?
We need friends in the county.